Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Welcome back. Behaviors sometimes can be hard to understand, especially when they seem to go in opposite directions from what we might expect. I know I'm stating the obvious here, so let me add an example that will help us navigate the study I would like to continue discussing that I first presented in the last episode, number 45. Let's just take a quite common example, but it is extreme if you haven't seen it. So, thinking about the perspective of horses and working with horses and this idea that animal behaviors can inform our understanding of humans, I want to ask you to imagine a herd of horses out on a field, and maybe it was trash day in the neighborhood or something, and a random plastic bag starts floating through the field. For those who have not seen what horses are typical to do, this can be extreme. For those who have, you know, it's quite common. I remember when I first started seeing horses do this, and it still fascinates me to this day. Horses do not like plastic bags. Everything in the nature of a floating plastic bag, essentially a piece of trash floating across a field, is alarming to a horse that's not acclimated to that experience. The way it moves, especially if there's a slight breeze, you can imagine, you've seen a plastic bag floating through the air. It just kind of floats, no predictable direction, kind of a bit eerie sometimes if it really gets kind of some air on it. And from a horse perspective, this is terrifying. As people who work with horses, our understanding seems to be that more than likely, it kind of represents a predator coming across the field, except it moves in ways a horse has not used to. Even if you've seen one plastic bag do this, you haven't seen them all because they're all going to look different the next time one comes across a field and different wind patterns and things. So it's eerie to them. The color doesn't make sense. You know, it's an unnatural color. Lots of reasons horses do not like plastic bags. And in fact, there's a whole amount of exercises and training that will be done with young horses who are going to be out in the public a lot because they really need to be acclimated to plastic bags in specifically. So thinking about that from a human perspective, though, the first time you see that, you know, you're kind of like, what's happening? What's wrong with them? And because they will alert, they will run, they will they will do all the things necessary to escape the situation. And horses by nature are typically flight animals. On occasion, when they have to, they'll go toward fight. But in mostly with plastic bags, they're going to flight. And it just looks kind of unexpected to see a herd of horses running away from a plastic bag. But it happens quite commonly. And it is one example that we can consider as a way to learn about our fellow mammals and have a extreme example of the differences between how humans and horses would respond to a plastic bag. And for me, this helps put things in context that because of the way they're seeing it, because of how their natures are, because of their instincts, it's just a different response than we do as humans. And so then taking that kind of awareness that one phenomena such as a plastic bag can cause such different presentations in between humans and horses, it stands to reason that other phenomena within species, say for example humans, could also look as we do not expect until we start to think about it from that being's perspective and the context in which they are living, the context in which they, their own natures are kind of made up, and how they get their needs met in terms of safety and security. So with that in mind, I would like to consider further the article that I mentioned in the last episode, number 45. And following on, we're going to consider how these authors are taking a variety of different pieces of information from the field to apply it and consider this idea of how behaviors can look unexpected, especially in children. And it's related to this idea of appeasement. So as a reminder, the title of the article is Entrapped Mother, Entrapped Child, Agonic Mode, Hierarchy and Appeasement in Intergenerational Abuse and Neglect, by authors Amos, Segal, and Cantor. More information are in the show notes for this episode and our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. In the previous episode, I provided some background on the literature from the authors, and I also shared some of the things I see in working with children and families who've had experiences such as the ones they are writing about. And I wanted to highlight one of the many things I noted while I was reviewing the article again, is that they lead off by reminding us that attachment theory is rooted in ethology. So let me explain that for a minute. Attachment theory is a large area of interest inside the field of psychology. Early thinkers in this area were John Bowlby, Mary Ainsworth, and Mary Main, who is one of Ainsworth's students and beyond. I've mentioned some of this work earlier in the podcast on episodes 3, 4, and 11. And they're talking about attachment theory being rooted in ethology. So ethology being a completely different field, and that being the science and study of animal behavior. So attachment theory has its, quote, roots in ethology. And you can kind of conceptualize it like this. Basically, it's really hard to study infants and children. They don't speak, talk, and sometimes don't behave in ways that adults can understand. And a lot of that is humans, we just take a while to develop. So we don't have the capacity to do those things in an adult way at younger ages. And so attachment theory then had to lean on our common nature with animals to try to understand what's happening in the human species when we are young. And it's what I've been mentioning similarly. We had to sort of go to the other language of other animals that we could observe and then contrast that with what we observe in the humans. And that's why I let off with an example about horses. Not necessarily that we're going to see young children be afraid of plastic bags, but once we can imagine the environment for the horses and their nature of needing to react to potential threats in an extreme way by running or escaping, we can then consider when we're looking at children in unique situations, what their behaviors signify in terms of trying to survive difficult circumstances. And that's true for humans at any age. I always see all behaviors in the service of survival. And I try to work from that perspective so that I can help someone consider different behaviors that might have less complications or consequences that could also support them in surviving. And these authors of the article actually, they reference, you know, as I mentioned, their article is summarizing a lot of different projects in the field to kind of come up with this applied sense of how things are working. And they reference Colt Mulder and Robbers. Their links then are in their article, and also Cantor and Price, Cantor being one of the authors on the study I'm discussing at the moment. And what they're helping us understand is that when you're looking at a group of horses, of humans, of many species, there are tension in the efforts to survive and get along. You know, we sometimes forget at times how many of our animal counterparts and even ourselves have to solve for basic needs each day. So there's sort of some natural tension. It's not to suggest that tension is a problem. It's actually a quite normal experience living in a finite, body and world. Tension would be present. And then the curiosity from people like myself is, what do we do in the face of that tension? And they're defining or using this definition from Colt Mulder and Robbers that, quote, tension results from combinations of uncertainty and insecurity, where uncertainty refers to a situation where it is impossible to know what is coming, and insecurity refers to an absence of togetherness and safety. So I'll explain this in the frame of that idea or example of horses in observing a plastic bag come across their field. So the uncertainty there is, from a horse perspective, you know, as humans, we seem to think we know what a plastic bag would do, most likely, or at least within range. But from the horse's perspective, they don't know what is coming. Like I mentioned, it's part of the reason we think they are so afraid of this phenomena of a plastic bag floating across the field is because of the way it moves. And once you slow down and actually watch it, the plastic bag does not move in predictable patterns. And so there is no way for them to know what's coming. Like, is it coming toward them? Is it going somewhere else? And then the insecurity is the absence of togetherness and safety. From a prey animal perspective, the ways that predators hunt is they separate the one that they're trying to hunt away from the herd. And so that absence of togetherness and safety, both of these things are present. And that's the tension now that you can imagine in the herd of horses. And so, leaving that example for a minute, now we're going to start to consider what the authors of this article really wanted to say, and that is learning about how children in abusive and neglectful homes may display behaviors that are unexpected. And we need to really think about the context of the larger situation for these children in order to understand how these behaviors could come into being. So as they remind us, appeasement behaviors are an attempt for a mammal or any animal to signal that they are peaceable. They don't want to fight. And they're reminding us that in mammals, these take many forms, and they can include a term that is new to me but describes a phenomena I see regularly, and that is what they're calling reverted escape. So like reverted, like you would revert back to. So reverted escape, and they define this as the seemingly paradoxical retreat to the dominant person, and doing this instead of true escape. And they're defining that as one form of appeasement. Others include infantile mimicry. So at any age, mimicking the dominant other in an infantile way, cowering, bowing, kneeling, sickness behavior, and self-destructive behavior. So For those of us who work a lot with children, you see many of these behaviors. In fact, some of them are what bring families to therapy when, for example, self-destructive behaviors and other things can be a signal that the child needs help. And so just thinking about each of these behaviors, reverted escape, infantile mimicry, cowering, bowing, kneeling, sickness behavior, and self-destructive behavior. Isn't that fascinating that they also see many of these things in animal counterparts? And what I'm hoping to do in this episode is to help us understand how a child in a situation, the one they're describing, is where the mother is very dominant and prioritizes her own needs ahead of the child, such that the child has to appease her in order to get its needs met. And what is so fascinating, this reverted escape, I mentioned it a little bit in the last episode, that one to most people is the hardest to understand, and that is why someone in a difficult household would choose to stay closest to the dominant caregiver, who is maybe the oppressive one. And this helps us understand that that is a common phenomena across humans and other animals, that staying with the dominant or oppressive member of the group is a seemingly paradoxical retreat to safety. And I mentioned last episode, it can be that children then in this circumstance feel like they have a little more control or perhaps awareness of what might happen in the face of uncertainty and insecurity. Or maybe they get like an advanced notice of uncertainty and insecurity. You see this a lot. It's very common for children in this circumstance to be the ones who know all about the family business, for example. They're ones who tend to act a little more mature than their actual age. They are sometimes the confidant for one of the caregivers, and they're aware of perhaps when bills are due, what the neighbors are up to. They're aware of situations that could cause the tension in the home to boil over. And so anytime sometimes we call it in the field over-parentified. In other words, they're acting or attempting to act like a parent role inside their family. We can now consider this role that children sometimes take on as a form of appeasement. They're trying to stay close to the dominant or oppressive caregiver in the home such that they can help manage or feel like maybe have a wish to manage the environment such that the oppressive caregiver stays appeased or calmed. And I found it fascinating too that they brought in other things like sickness and self-destructive behavior. I actually had not considered either of those in this way, so I'll have to start reframing my views on that and see if I find it to make sense from a clinical perspective. And that's actually what I'm hoping this podcast provides overall, is a way to continue to look at literature and research and determine how and if it will change or needs to apply to the way we practice. So I'd like to summarize the last couple episodes and how I think they apply currently to the way I practice, and maybe how I will include some considerations at this time. As a reminder, the thinking here is that humans and animals are similar enough in our physical makeup that we act in certain and similar ways. Not always is this transferable from one species to another. It's kind of like other languages. You have to learn which words go where. And in some languages, you know, the variety of how the sentences are structured are quite different. So that's true, and in fact, probably amplified in the way that I'm thinking about it here. But nevertheless, we can kind of triangulate what we see in other species, what we see in humans, and what we understand from our patients to get an idea of their specific environment. Some of the ways that animals and humans signal that they like to remain peaceable and do not wish a conflict are a category of research called appeasement behaviors. In this and the last episode, I've presented an article that takes a wide variety of information and applies it to the thinking and understanding about children who are in difficult circumstances with an oppressive caregiver, and maybe there's abuse or neglect in the home, and how they react to that environment to signal their intent to remain peaceable and to appease the oppressive caregiver. There are some behaviors that do not make sense on the face of them, but once you understand the environment from which the child is operating and their intent to survive that the best way possible, again, I see all behaviors in the service of survival, it starts to make sense. And specifically, behaviors such as a reverted escape were presented here, such that the child may choose to stay very close to the oppressive adult. And one reason I'm highlighting this so specifically on the podcast is because many people in the child's world, teachers, counselors, coaches, would have a hard time understanding the full context. And so I'm hoping to provide some of that here. And from a clinical perspective, then we can consider these behavior displays as reflections of the internal environment for the child and their experience of their world. And hopefully with this understanding can start to intervene in ways that actually make a difference. Because in my experience, getting to the understanding of why someone is behaving in a certain way and kind of trusting them that there must be a reason for that has been very helpful to see clinical changes when I am honored to be able to support someone in this situation. And that's actually how I want to end the episode, is speaking about my own clinical views on situations where, you know, there are difficult things happening. I don't want to minimize that. And one thing I do is to first see people as different from their behaviors. So it's possible to separate what someone is doing and who they are. And that's the first place I start from in order to support them. And the second thing that I often remind myself of is that humans are social creatures and we learn by what was done to us. So if I am working with a family and there are difficult circumstances in the home, I'm going to remember right off the bat that whatever is happening there is in the service of survival. And people are behaving in ways that were done to them. And without any other information, those behaviors will just continue and continue. In fact, I covered some of social learning theory in episode 17, but the idea is that, you know, we learn by what is done to us and then we do it to others. And so I then remind myself that I wouldn't be meeting this family, I wouldn't be meeting this child if they didn't want something to change. So I have the honor of meeting them in my office because they want something to be different. They may not know what it is or how to get there. That's my job. But they are meeting me or someone like me because they want things to be different. And that's the place that I start working from, is we all want things to be better. I have ideas based on what I've researched and my thinking and how I've continued to try to improve my own ability to practice. I have ideas on what that might be. They have ideas on what that might be. They might be getting feedback from others in the world. We can all work together towards making some changes. So with me, In my work, there are no shaming techniques and no calculations of good and bad behaviors, just a trusting that we are all walking toward the same goal, some days more quickly than others, but we are all working together to get there. And that has helped me a lot, especially at times when I'm learning about that child's understanding, is to really just slow down and remember that when all these people are working toward the same goal, we will get there eventually. And part of the therapy is working and walking together toward that goal. And so it's okay that it takes time. In fact, the time it takes sometimes will help the child and the family in the next situation and the next situation that they encounter, because tension will always be present. And it's more about how someone reacts in the face of that tension that I'm interested in when I'm working with them therapeutically. Thanks a lot. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.